I investigated the story of the Cape May monster, wherever I got the idea that I could find out anything in particular. Somebody in Cape May wrote to me that the thing was a highly undesirable carcass of a whale, which had been towed out to sea. Somebody else wrote to me that it was a monster with a tusk 12 feet long, which he had seen. He said that, if I'd like to have it, he'd send me a photograph of the monster. After writing of having seen something with a tusk 12 feet long, he sent me a photograph of something with two tusks, each 6 feet long. But only one of the seeming tusks is clear in the picture, and it could be, not a tusk, but part of the jawbone of a whale, propped up tusk-wise. In the London Daily Mail, December 27, 1924, appeared a story of an extraordinary carcass that was washed up, on the coast of Natal, October 25, 1924. It was 47 feet long, and was covered with white hair, like a polar bear's. I won't go into this, because I consider it a worthless yarn. In accordance with my methods, considering this a foolish and worthless yarn, I sent out letters to South African newspapers, calling upon readers, who could, to investigate this story. Nobody answered. In the New Zealand Times, March 19, 1883, it is said that bones of an unknown monster, about 40 feet long, had been found upon the coast of Queensland, and had been taken to Rockhampton, Queensland. There are the remains of what must have been an enormous snout, 8 feet long, in which the respiratory passage are yet traceable. These could not have been the remains of a beaked whale. Whatever hip bones a cetacean has are only vestigial structures. In a sperm whale, 55 feet long, the hip bones are detached and atrophied relics of former uses, each about 1 foot long. A hip bone of the Queensland monster is described as enormous. In looking over the London Daily News, I came upon an item. Trawlers of the steamship Bomatic had brought to Grimsby the skull of an unknown monster, dredged up in the Atlantic, north of Scotland, Daily News, June 26, 1908. The size of the skull indicated an animal the size of an elephant, and it was in a wonderful state of preservation. It was unlike the skull of any cetacean, having eye sockets a foot across. From the jaws hung a leathery tongue, 3 feet long. I found, in the Grimsby Telegraph, June 29, a reproduction of a photograph of this skull, with the long tongue hanging from the beak-like jaws. I made a sketch of the skull, as pictured, and sent it with a description to the British Museum, Natural History. I received an answer from Mr. W. P. Pecraft, who wrote that he had never seen any animal with such a skull and I have seen a good many. It is just possible that nobody else has ever seen anything much resembling a sketch that I'd make of anything, but that has nothing to do with descriptions of the tongue. According to Mr. Pecraft, no known cetacean has such a tongue. I went on searching, trying to come upon something about a hairy monster, furred, anything except scaled, or with a hide like a whale's. London newspapers, July 6, 1913. A lengthy telegram that had been sent by Mr. Hartwell Condor, Tasmanian state mining engineer, to Mr. Wallace, the Secretary of Mines, of Tasmania that, upon April 20, 1913, two of Mr. Condor's companions, named Davies and Harris, had seen a huge, unknown animal, near Macquarie Harbour, Tasmania. The animal was about 15 feet long. It had a very small head, only the size of the head of a kangaroo dog. It had a thick, arched neck, passing gradually into the barrel of the body. It had no definite tail and no fins. It was furred, the coat in appearance resembling that of a horse of chestnut color, well groomed and shining. It had 4 distinct legs. It traveled by bounding, i.e., by arching its back and gathering up its body, so that the footprints of the 4 feet were level with those of the hind feet. It made definite footprints. These showed circular impressions, with a diameter, measured, of 9 inches, and the marks of claws, about 7 inches long, extending outward from the body. There was no evidence for or against webbing. In reply to my inquiries, Mrs. Condor, North Terrace, Burnie, Tasmania wrote to me, as asked to by Mr. Condor, saying that the published description is accurate, and that, unless there be a seal with jointed flippers, upon which the creature could raise itself and run, Mr. Condor could not be altogether convinced that the animal was a seal. I have not looked for record of any such known seal. I take for granted that the seal type has conventionalized so that there is no such seal. It may be that there have been several finds of remains of a large, long-snouted animal that is unknown to the paleontologists, because, though it has occasionally appeared here, it has never been indigenous to this earth. New York, Sunday, November 28, 1930. Monster in ice has long snout. Skeleton and considerable flesh, of an unknown animal found in the ice, upon Glacier Island, Alaska. The animal was 24 feet long, head 59 inches long, snout 39 inches long. In some of the reports it was said that the animal was covered with hair, or fur. Conventionally one thinks of mammoths of Siberia, preserved for ages in ice. But, if nothing proves anything, simply that something is found in ice may not mean that for ages it was preserved in ice. 10. Unknown, luminous things, or beings, have often been seen, sometimes close to this earth, and sometimes high in the sky. It may be that some of them were living things that occasionally come from somewhere else in our existence, but that others were lights on the vessels of explorers, or voyagers, from somewhere else. From time to time, luminous objects, or beings, have been reported from Brown Mountain, North Carolina. They appear, and then for a long time are not seen, and then they appear again. See the Literary Digest, November 7, 1925. I have other records. The luminosities travel, as if with motions of their own. They are brilliant, globular forms, and move in the sky, with a leisureliness and duration that exclude any explanation in meteoric terms. For many years, there had been talk upon this subject, and then, in the year 1922, people of North Carolina, asking for a scientific investigation, were referred to the United States Geological Survey. A geologist was sent from Washington to investigate these things in the sky. One imagines, but most likely only faintly, the superiority of this geologist from Washington. He heard stories from the natives. He contrasted his own sound principles with the irresponsible gab of denizens, and went right to the investigation, scientifically. He went out on a road, and saw lights, and made his report. 47% of the lights that he saw were automobile headlights, 33% of them were locomotive headlights, 10% were lights in houses, and 10% were bush fires. Tot that up, and see that efficiency can't go further. The geologist from Washington, having investigated nothing that he had been sent to investigate, returned to Washington, which also, by the way, is a place where there's plenty to investigate, and I suppose that the people of North Carolina will be no wiser, as to these things in the sky, if some other time they appeal to a United States Fish Commission, or the Department of Labor. I don't know to just what degree my accusation, in these matters, is of the laziness and feeble-mindedness of scientists. Or, instead of accusing, I am simply pointing out everybody's inability seriously to spend time upon something, which, according to his preconceptions, is nonsense. Scientists, in matters of our data, have been like somebody in Europe, before the year 1492, hearing stories of lands to the west, going out on the ocean for an hour or so, in a rowboat, and then saying, whether exactly in these words, or not, oh, hell, there ain't no America. In Knowledge, September, 1913, Count de Cibour enjoyed his laziness, or incompetence, which a merciful providence, bent upon keeping us human beings reconciled to being human beings, made him think was his own superiority. He told a story of foolish, credulous people, in North Norfolk, England, who, in the winter of 1907-08, believed that a pair of shining things, moving about the fields, could not be explained as he explained them. We are told of a commonplace ending of this alleged mystery, that finally a gamekeeper shot one of these objects, and found that it was a common barn owl, phosphorescent with decayed wood from its nesting place, or with a fungus disease of its feathers. According to other accounts, these things were as brilliant as electric lights. But a phosphorescent owl could not shine with a light like an electric light. So de Sibuer described the light as a pale, yellow glow, such as a phosphorescent owl could shine with. Science concerns itself with adaptations, and science itself is adaptation. We are reminded of the Rev. Hugi. He could not explain downpours, so he turned downpours into a small quantity, which he could explain. De Sibuer knew nothing about this subject, from his own experiences. We go to the same records to which he went. Like him, we find just about what we want to find. In the London Times, December 10, 1907, and in following issues, are accounts of these luminous objects, which were flying about the fields of North Norfolk, having been reported by Mr. R. W. Purdy, a well-known writer upon biologic subjects. Among other attempts to assimilate with the known, or among other expressions of a worldwide antipathy to the finding out of anything new, was the idea that owls are sometimes luminous. The idea came first, or the solution of the problem was published first, and then the problem was fitted to the solution. This is said to be a favorite method of ratiocination with inmates of a home for the mentally deficient, but I should think that one of these inmates should feel at home anywhere. De Sibuer and others fitted in a story that a luminous owl had been shot. I think that at times there may be faintly luminous owls, because I accept that, under some circumstances, almost anything may be luminous. English Mechanic, 10-15 case of a man with a luminous toe.